Weather. I hope that everybody's had a good afternoon, had a chance to get some rest or glorify God some way. I hope that everyone's had a good afternoon. But tonight I'm also excited because you're going to hear the untold story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Because everybody knows what happens in Sodom and Gomorrah, right? It's one of the first stories we tell children in Bible classes. It's one of those real early stories. And what I think I'd like you to notice tonight is that Sodom and Gomorrah was actually a series of decisions that happened in the upcoming to the colossal destruction of those cities. And that if those decisions weren't made, I don't know if those cities would have been destroyed or not, but we probably wouldn't have much record of it. It wouldn't be real important to what happened in the Bible story. And, you know, part of the reason this came to my mind is because last week I was going through some of my old lessons, and you guys know how I don't always love series. Is that right? Series? I don't always love series. Because I sometimes feel like you stretch one sermon out over six and people will get kind of tired of it after a time. So instead, if I have a sermon that's going to take more than one thing, I try to sprinkle it out over the years. And as I was looking back over this last year, I was like, I've forgotten about Abraham. Do you guys remember that? I said I was going to teach a series of sermons on Abraham, and I forgot about him. So I hope that he'll forgive me. But in the meantime, I did want to pick up with Sodom and Gomorrah because it starts with Abraham, I think. This event that we have recorded in the Bible starts with Abraham. And it's an important one, too. You know, one of the things we might not always apply about Sodom and Gomorrah is that they serve as a very, very vivid illustration of damnation. I mean, in Matthew 10, this is what Jesus says in Matthew 10, 14. He says, "If anyone will not receive you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that house or town. Truly I say to you, it will be more bearable in the day of judgment for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town." 2 Peter 2 talks about it too. We're not going to read verse 8, but verse 8 we're going to reference in a minute. But in verse 6, we read, if by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, he condemned them to extinction, making them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly. He pretty well just says it there. Sodom and Gomorrah are an example of what's going to happen if you don't follow God, all right? Jude, which we just studied in our Wednesday night class 2 weeks ago, I think. Jude had this to say in chapter 1 and verse 5. "I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe, and the angels who did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling. He's kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire, serve as an example by undergoing a punishment of eternal fire." This is an illustration of what's waiting for people who don't follow God. And so a lot of people know what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. And a lot of times we talk about the really vivid story that it was. Picture yourself being Lot and fleeing from this town accompanied by two messengers from God himself, and feeling the ground shake and smelling the sulfur as God rained fire from the sky on these cities. And then your wife turns around and turns into a pillar of salt. You could go back and show your kids. I don't actually know why you would. But to teach them about God. That's why you would. You would do that to teach them about God. But that's a physical thing you could see. A pillar of salt. And just to illustrate, you follow God, right? If God says, get up from your land and go, you do it. If God says, flee, you flee. If God says, follow me, you follow him. That's what we're meant to take from Sodom and Gomorrah. And to that point, I said this starts with Abram. Abram starts as a powerfully good example of how that works. I mean, if you look at chapter 12, this is a passage, again, I think many people are familiar with. But God said to Abram in verse 1, this is Genesis chapter 12. And I'm going to read 10 verses here. Because Abram starts well. "The Lord said to Abram, Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Verse 4. So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran, and Abram took Sarai his wife and Lot his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired in Haran, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. When they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh, and at that time the Canaanites were in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built there an altar to the Lord who appeared to him. And from there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed on, still going toward the Negev. Now there was a famine in the land, verse 10 says. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. So God came to Abram and he said, "Get up, leave, go," and Abram went. And like I said, that's a very good start. That's a very good place for Abram to be. And we talked about this when we were studying Abram in our Wednesday night's class that shows a lot of faith on Abram's part. And we're about to be a little bit critical about Abram, but we said this then too when we were studying through Abraham in our Wednesday night classes. We said it's kind of hard to be hard on him. He shows us, after all, that faith is a growth thing. You know, you grow in your faith. That's true. And we're going to stick with that. But I want you to notice the decisions that Abram started making here. So the first decision was very good. God said, "Get up and go." Abram got up and went. It's a very good decision. Then as Abram went through, and if I meant to put a map up on the board and just had a snafu in my plans tonight, but Shechem is kind of down toward the middle of what we're used to calling Israel, sort of in Palestine. So he got to Shechem, and he made an altar of the Lord there, and God told him in verse 7, "To your offspring I will give this land." So as I understand it, especially looking at a map, I believe that Abram had reached basically the center of the land God had told him he was going to get. And God said to him when he was there in that land, "To you I will give this land." Now what Abram does next is a little different. Some think that he had some insight from God. You know, he was given the instruction that where his feet fell, God would give him the land that his feet touched. A couple chapters later, God does tell him that the corruption of the inhabitants of the land was not complete. That was in chapter 15. So that did happen eventually, but at this point, I don't know that any of that had actually happened yet. At this point, it looks like Abram gets to the land, and God says, "This is it. This is your land. This is your home." And then look at verse 9. We read, "Abram journeyed on, so going toward the Negev." Now, the Negev is a term that was sometimes used of a specific place, a body of water, but most of the time it just meant toward the southern region of Palestine. That's what they call it. Kind of like we call some parts of Lexington, Hamburg. Is that a part of Lexington? I don't actually still know. Okay, maybe. Yeah. But we call it Hamburg, even though it's still in Lexington. That's kind of what the Negev was. So he was journeying on, you could read that and accurately understand it, toward the south part of the land of Palestine. And he stopped in Bethel, and he made an altar. That was good. That was a good decision. But then in verse 10, we read that there was a famine, so he went down to Egypt. Now, I'm not saying that it was sinful, that this was an immoral decision for Abram to go down to Egypt, because honestly, I don't think it was. I think even if God promised you, "You will inherit the land of Kentucky," and then Kentucky had a famine or you lost your job or something, and you went and you looked for a job somewhere else, I'm not saying that that would necessarily be a sinful thing for you to do. I'm not saying that was actually sinful on Abram's part, but why did he go to Egypt? He could have just stopped. At least at this point, I don't see an instruction from God telling him that he needed to go on. I mean, and even if he did need to explore the whole land and get an idea of what God was going to give him, when there was a famine, he went to Egypt instead of staying there. And like I said, I would say this is probably morally questionable. I think if some people would say Abraham did something wrong here, And some people would say that he didn't. But I don't know that I could exactly say that this was sinful. Which brings us to chapter 12. Excuse me, verse 11 and 12 of chapter 10. We're in the same verse 10 of chapter 12. Give me long enough, I get it out. So that's where we'll be. So he went down to Egypt. And in verse 11, when he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, "I know that you're a woman beautiful in appearance. And when the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but they will let you live." Now again, if we pause here and we observe this, he was probably right. You know, historically, Egypt was not really ever a God-fearing country. They had a period where they kind of considered him maybe, but historically, they were never really a God-fearing country. And Abram came from Haran. Most of the research you can find on Haran seems to indicate that it was also a pretty wicked place. Lots of idol worship. It seemed to be very steeped in idol worship. And there are certain sins that go hand in hand with idol worship in ancient cultures that were certainly present in Haran. So it was coming from a wicked place, passed through the promised land, and going to a wicked place. And he was probably right in his assessment that if they knew Sarai was his wife, they would abuse him to get to her. But then look at the decision he made. Verse 13, "Say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life might be spared for your sake." Now, many people pointed out this wasn't exactly a lie. Abram and Sarai were kind of sisters. If I remember correctly, they shared a father, but not a mother. I might have that a little bit, but they were kind of related. So it wasn't entirely incorrect for Abram to say this of her. She's my sister, you know? But on the other hand, look at the reasons. He said, "Say you are my sister so that it will go well with me." He's saying, you, my wife, go be attractive to other men, be available for them so that good things will happen to me, your husband. He even goes on to say that it may go well with me because of you and that my life may be spared for your sake. If I understand that correctly, that's like Abram saying, you go give yourself up for me. That's okay. And even if I'm reading a little too much into that, which I might be, I think that's what that means, but even if I am, he was still saying he was okay with another man taking his wife and making her his wife at the expense of his prosperity. I don't really see any other way that you can cut that. And in verse 15, he was right. When the princes of Pharaoh saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And for her sake, he dealt well with Abram. And he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male servants, female donkeys, and camels. So it worked. At Sarah's expense, Abram prospered. In verse 17, the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. So Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you've done to me? Why did you not tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go." I want to point out a couple things about this. For one, I don't know that we've always made this application, but look at the situation. Abram, God's chosen person, goes to his promised land and then leaves it, continues traveling. When he left it, he went into Egypt. When he was in Egypt, he received some goods, but was in a really scary position unless God got him out of Egypt. God used plagues to get him out of Egypt, and then he left Egypt with some of the possessions of the current Pharaoh. Does that sound like anything else we've studied? The same thing happened to Abram's seed, to his offspring. You know, the Israelites went to Egypt because of a famine. Joseph's household went down to Egypt because they ran out of food, so they went to Egypt because of a famine. And in Egypt, they prospered for a good time. As long as the Pharaoh who knew Joseph was alive, he treated those children well. And then when that Pharaoh died, they became slaves. They got into a scary situation. So God sent plagues on that Pharaoh, and they escaped from that Pharaoh. By God's deliverance, they left Egypt. Did you guys see a little bit of poetry, a little bit of symmetry in that justice. And I want to recap really quickly from Lot's point of view. What we don't really read a whole lot about here is what Lot was doing this whole time, but we know he was there. We know that Abram had taken him and these people with him on this journey. So Lot would have seen Abram pass through God's promised land, which, like we said, I'd call that morally debatable, and it kind of depends on what you think his reasons for. There is some context, some contextual reason for his decisions to do so. But then when Lot saw his father figure, Abram, make the decision when in the promised land to move to Egypt because of a famine. So to provide food for his family, Lot saw his father figure move to a more profitable place. And then Lot saw when they got there in Egypt, the family was in danger. And so Abram made the decision to tell a half lie at the expense of his wife, to put her in a position of sexual immorality in order to be treated well by the inhabitants of the land. And like I said, you know, there may be some more background here that we don't know. It may have kind of been this way in Haran as well. But nonetheless, Lot basically saw Abram go into this land and just kind of be cool with the fact that his wife was going to be somebody else's concubine. So when chapter 13 starts this way, I don't know that we should actually be this surprised. Look at chapter 13 in verse 1. So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot went with him into the Negev. Now Abram was very rich in livestock and silver and in gold, and he journeyed on from the Negev as far as Bethel to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai. So see, he left Egypt, he went back to Bethel and Ai. Went back to where he was before all this started. So verse 4, the place where he had made an altar at the first, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Now I want to pause here. I would say Abram learned the right lesson. Like I said, it's hard to be hard on Abram. A lot of what he teaches us is that faith is a growing process, you know? And it seems like he came out of Egypt and he went back to where this started, and he called on the name of the Lord. He'd already built an altar there. He didn't necessarily need to build another one. But he called to the Lord and he recommitted himself to the Lord. I don't know that there was much of a covenant at this point, but if there had been one, then that would have been what he was doing. But look at verse 5. And Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support them both dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. At that time, the Canaanites and the Perizzites were dwelling in the land. Then Abram said to Lot, "Let there be no strife between you and me, and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, then I will go to the right, or if you take the right hand, then I will go to the left." And look at how Lot made this decision. Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east, so they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. Did you notice what Lot did? A lot of times we really dog on Lot. He moved his tent as far as Sodom. I've heard sermons about Sodom and Gomorrah that point out that, you know, Lot just edged closer and closer and closer to sin, and it's no surprise then that he got so caught up in it. But I think we actually should see this decision coming from further away than just where he put his tent, because, and I'm not saying this is Abram's fault. I should clarify that, I think. Because Lot made his decision. Abram didn't make that. Abram gave him the choice, and Lot made his decision. But there's a phrase there that we read that is very, very important in verse 10. It was like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. When had he seen the land of Egypt? But when Abram went there. When had he seen someone choose prosperity over purity? When Abram went to Egypt. And so, like I said, I don't think this is Abram's fault. I believe this was Lot's decision. And I don't know that there's much that Abram would have done differently if Lot had chosen the other place. I guess that's kind of speculation. But I know that Lot had seen these decisions. He was making this decision just like Abram had made that decision. And so I think that while Abram learned the right lesson from his brief time in Egypt, I think Lot learned the wrong one. I think Lot looked at the same events, and he learned the opposite of what Abram learned. Interestingly, in chapter 12 and verse 10, when we read that Abram moved to Egypt to abide there, that word means live. It appears that Abram moved to Egypt with the intent of staying there. The land God promised me was barren, so I'll come to this more fruitful one. And so Lot saw Abraham choose that way. And I think that, in 2 Peter 2 and verse 8 actually says Lot was a righteous man. I don't believe that his decision was so much made because he didn't care about immorality. 2 Peter 2 and verse 8 says that his righteous soul was tortured. He cared about morality. But his decision was made because he'd looked at Abraham and seen his decisions, and he just emulated them. There's a strong case for that. He made a decision based on prosperity and not purity. And what's interesting is if God had gone to Abram, and if he'd said to Abram, Abram, I want you to choose right now. Would you rather your nephew live in a pure place of peace or live in a place that's going to be destroyed? Don't you think Abram, if he had that choice right in front of him, would have said, you know, I really would love for him to live in a pure place of peace. No sane guardian or parent would say, I would love for my child to live in a place that's going to be destroyed. But what Abram didn't see is that all along, the smaller decisions he was making had a bigger influence on the people around him. That's the untold story of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's that the small decisions we make have a big influence in ways we can't always see. In our defense, we are just humans. We can't see into the future. But when we make decisions, even small ones, we need to consider what they're going to look like even generations down the road. And I want to put this in context very well for us. You know, we do have students here. I don't see many of them tonight. But my students, you know, I'm talking about children on up to college students. And this really applies very well to single people as well, people who are not married as well. Think about the decisions that we face in life. You know, I want you to know something going into this next part. If you're not married, if you're in school, if you're young, if you're still under the household of your parents, I want you to understand God has promised you that if you follow him, he will take you to a prosperous land. He will take you to a perfect place where no matter what job or education you had on earth, you won't be hungry, you won't be in need, you won't fight, you won't compete with other students or chiller kids. You'll have everything you'll need. God has promised you that. And so those times when you stress out, when you're worried about your future, when you're worried that things aren't going to line up just like your career plan has led, I want you to remember, God has promised to take care of you. But on the other hand, remember this. Your decisions are incredibly important. Incredibly important. Your choices, if you're not married, about dating, about spending time with the friends you spend time with, about the substances you may partake in, have bigger consequences than you can think about. There's a song that I hate on the radio right now. I don't know if I've used this as a sermon illustration yet. It's been begging for it. You guys heard that song, How Am I Ever Gonna Get to Be Old and Wise If I Ain't Ever Young and Crazy? Have you guys heard that song? Oh, it drives me nuts. I hear it probably 3 times a week, and I can't stand that song because most of the old wise people I know didn't do drugs. Like, most of the old and wise people I know are married to the same person they've always loved, and they have only ever loved that one person. Most of the old and wise people I know were not alcoholics in high school. You know, in fact, for every case of someone who has learned from bad decisions in your life that you could show me, I could show you at least five other examples of people who thought through their decisions and thought about the future and actually survived. I mean, when you make decisions, young people, remember Abram and Lot, and remember that your decisions matter. And married people, we need to think about that too. And married people, we need to remember that our decisions matter as well. And I want you to know something, married people. I say this to myself and my wife, and I remind myself of this all the time. We're part of something bigger than just a marriage. You know, the way most people see marriage, it's something that ideally you should commit to, but it can be broken now and then. God has promised if you and your spouse follow Him, you will be together for eternity. Isn't that awesome? You know, if you're not married yet, you'll find this out when you get married. One of the greatest things about being married is that you don't have to worry about breaking up anymore if you're doing it right. You know, that was something that drove me crazy about dating, the instability of a dating relationship. Marriage is wonderful, but what's even better is that if you follow God your whole life, you will be together for eternity. I mean, that's awesome. On the other hand, think about the decisions that we make, married people. You know, as a preacher, it's not uncommon. It's happened a lot. And it's sometimes odd because I don't know that I'm necessarily the best person to tell things like this. But people come and they tell you, well, I got caught looking at something I wasn't supposed to be looking at online. You know, it's probably stereotypical of men, but I think men and women both do it, and we think those secret sins, they don't matter so much. They're just little decisions we can keep to ourselves, and if our spouse never finds out about it, then what's it really hurting? You know, that flirtatious relationship we may develop with somebody at work, it's not ever going to turn into anything. I would never do anything with that person, and if it's not ever found out, then what's it really hurting? The answer is those small decisions matter. And parents, I want you to understand that if you follow God and you raise your children to follow God, their Father, their Heavenly Father, will take care of them for eternity. You know, Friday on Chloe's birthday, I told Amelia, I was like, before we had kids, I'd never preached about parenting, because I never felt like I felt not qualified. But now that I have a child, I feel less qualified to preach about parenting. Is that because I'm not perfect? I'm not saying this is like the perfect father. I'm most definitely not the perfect father. And I've only had 2 years of this with one child. Some of you have way more kids than I do and have had them for much longer. And you make mistakes, you make choices, and you should know that with those overnight stays in the hospital, you know, with those mistakes that you make, even through something as awful as death, God's there for you while you're parenting. If you raise your kids and you follow God and you raise your children, do the same, you will spend eternity with God, and that's awesome. But on the other hand, those decisions matter. You know, those choices that you make about whether or not your children attend worship with you, it might not seem like that big a deal. It might seem like, hey, every once in a while on a Wednesday night when they have homework, they need to do that homework. But think about it. Are you choosing prosperity? Or are you choosing purity? You know? And those decisions that you make about extracurriculars. Listen, if I ever, I'm gonna publicly commit to this, okay? That's how much I believe it. If we ever stop bringing her to worship because of some extracurricular activity, I want you to pull this sermon up online and make me listen to it and call me a hypocrite, because we think about those moments, they're actually great opportunities. Can you imagine what it looks like to your child if on a Wednesday night you go pick them up a little bit early from practice and you bring them to worship? They may not like it then, but when they grow up and they're faced with a difficult situation, they will remember that you chose purity over prosperity. The fact is that as parents, we really have to focus on teaching our children about God and giving them every opportunity to learn about God that we want them to have. So think about your decisions. Think about, will your child see your influence, and will they choose Sodom and Gomorrah, or will they choose God because of your influence? And if you're here tonight and you're not baptized, or if there's sin in your life, think about your decision. I know that it may seem like you have a whole list of very good reasons to stay in Egypt. But I want to encourage you, because the truth is, as much as those small decisions, those small reasons might seem relatively meaningless, they mean a great deal. They could, in fact, mean the difference between getting to the promised land or burning up in Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember, that's why we have Sodom and Gomorrah. It's that illustration of damnation. Don't go there. If you haven't been baptized in tonight, think about your decision. If there's a sin you need to repent of, then think about it as we stand and sing.